This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Our favourite festive scenes.
Jules, I'm incredibly disappointed with you.
Why?
Because you didn't sing it.
Oh. I don't really have that deep bass voice that sounds best with that song, so...
You can just imagine it then. It's Christmas time!
Yes, it's our yearly Christmas episode. Of course it's yearly, Christmas happens every year. But it's our Christmas episode, and we try and do something a bit different. Last year we gave you the gritty details on the pagan and sexual origins of carols, which, you know, was edifying for everybody. And before that we've looked at our favourite cheesy Christmas films. This year we are looking at the anatomy of scenes, whether they are actually Christmas focused or not, and how they make us feel Christmassy, how they evoke the feelings of the season, or not, as the case may be.
Maybe
Christmas is used as a juxtaposition to something that is far darker or grittier. So we're basically just going to take it in turns, bring up a scene, discuss it, dissect it, because we are the Dissecting Dragons, and go from there. It should be festive and fun, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we should just have the sound of bells in the background.
I know, I feel like we need sleigh bells from somewhere. Maybe
I'll
see if I can find a sleigh bell track.
Okay. All right. Well, Jules, why don't you start us off then?
I will. When we talked about doing this episode, and I know this is on your list as well, so we'll talk about it together, but what came to mind immediately was Harry Potter. And basically, I know that Christmas is kind of used in the Harry Potter books basically to mark the year passing, because it's part of the school year. But I like the way J.K. Rowling does it, because she uses it to underline Harry's sense of family while at Hogwarts and his complete lack of sense of family when he's back home with the Dursleys. He never spends a Christmas back with his aunt and uncle and cousin. He spends his Christmases at Hogwarts or, you know, later on at the Burrow with Ron's family.
Yeah.
And it's just such an excellent juxtaposition, and I think the films really captured that.
Yeah,
certainly in the Philosopher's Stone, when all the actors were still really young, and it was a case of it was like watching someone who'd never really had a proper Christmas suddenly have a Christmas to celebrate in a place where he actually felt valued and felt like he had a family.
Yeah.
So it was a place that was trying to regularly kill him, but at the same time, that's where he belonged, and it was this sense of belonging. And the way they filmed it, even, I read about it, and obviously I've been to Harry Potter Studios quite recently, so I got to see the sets again. And everything's warm, everything's sort of like this rich, cold red type colour and contrasting green, and, you know, you've got glints of gold and things. Everything feels like an afternoon by an open fire.
Yeah, it really does. And they really do capture the aesthetic of Christmas, in that it is snowing, you know. They're up basically in Scotland, they've got snow, they've got the roaring fires, they've got that kind of old castle, but not like a scary old castle, but as you say, very warm, you know. It feels like a typical Christmas from a storybook, and it's brilliant in that respect. It's just fantastically, aesthetically wonderful. And you are right that basically the thing that it really captures is that sense of welcoming and home and warmth and comfort. And also, I think you can't really mention the fact that it feels Christmassy without mentioning the feasts that they have.
No, you really can't. And it is kind of the season of plenty. It's like the ghost of Christmas present has just rocked up and unloaded food everywhere.
Yeah. I also particularly like that. I think it feels especially Christmassy for me, the first one, because Harry comes down and Ron says, "Are you going to open your presents?" And Harry's like, "I have presents?" And also the fact that actually, with a little bit of perspective, you understand that Ron, who can go home to have a wonderful Christmas with his family, you know, which will be, you know, full of joy and cheer and all of that, has decided that he is going to stay at Hogwarts with Harry.
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliant.
That gets me every time, and it is brilliant. It is this sense of, it's not really the family that you landed with, it's the family that chooses you, that you choose in return.
Yeah.
That is important. So, yeah, it does tap into the favourite trope of found family, but there is also the sense of, you know, Ron's kind of a bit dismissive about his Christmas presents because he doesn't come from a wealthy family. He's not getting the latest fruit stick or anything like that. But for Harry, it's a revelation. I mean, he's just, I can't remember whether it was a 50 pence piece he got sent the first year or whether it was a pair of Uncle Vernon's socks. It was something really naff.
Yeah.
I think it might have been the 50 pence piece.
Yeah.
And he's just, to suddenly have someone thinking of him and wanting to send him something, even if it was homemade, like the sweater and the box of fudge or whatever it was that Mrs. Weasley sent him.
Yeah.
He doesn't really go into details because he's an 11-year-old boy, but you can tell that this has really affected him.
Yeah.
And it is the contrast. And it makes you feel Christmassy because it's the sense of, this isn't commercial at all. This is, again, like I've said, a late winter afternoon with the snow outside, but sitting with a friend in front of a fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what they do. They sit there and they play chess and exploding snap and they eat too much at the feast. And it's just brilliant. It's his best Christmas ever. For Ron, it's kind of like, well, it's not Hogwarts. This is kind of cool. But
yeah.
For Harry, it's like, this is amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is brilliant. But also, I think the thing that really makes it is that, as you mentioned, these presents, they're not commercial, but they're very typical kind of comfort presents, if that makes sense. And it's exactly the kind of thing that you get in these old stories that kind of arcs back to this very old tradition. So, you know, handmade clothes, food stuff, sweetmeats. And then, of course, he gets this invisibility cloak, which has that magical, mystical nature that is also very associated with Christmas. And this was pretty impressive, considering that this is an entire book about magical, mystical stuff happening constantly. And yet, the invisibility cloak added that level of mystery and kind of really deepened it, which you really want for Christmas, because it's also the season of mystery and mysticism and things like that. So that was really excellent, but also the fact that it was then, this is related to your father, so it's a hand-me-down. Yeah. So there's that sense of antiquity, that sense of family that's coming through there as well. So the choice of presents just screams home, comfort, and a little bit of mystery, which I think is why probably that first book encapsulates Christmas better than pretty much any of the others.
Yeah, although it's very much a present in the others, isn't it? I mean, it's very much present, not a present. It's present, not a present. Sorry, slip of the tongue. It's never something that's skipped over.
No.
And it's particularly poignant by the time you get to things like The Order of the Phoenix, whereby Harry's holding on to this terrible secret where he saw through Nagini's eyes when she attacked Mr. Weasley.
Yeah.
But he's still part of this family, and yet he's thinking, oh God, do I deserve to be?
Yeah.
And then, even more poignantly, when you get to the Deathly Hallows, when Ron's left them and it's just him and Hermione and they're walking through Godric's Hollow and they've got no idea whether they're ever going to be able to go back to what seems to be home ever again. And there's no presents or anything, there's no feast, but Hermione conjures a wreath for Harry's parents' grave.
Yeah.
And that is as much Christmas as anything else. It's all about the friendship and the closeness.
Yeah. Especially significant again because Harry's first Christmas was with Ron.
Yeah.
And every Christmas subsequently has been with Ron, you know, being part of that family. And now it's all gone. It's all under threat. I mean, it's just, yeah, you're absolutely right. Christmas holds a very poignant place in all of the books. And actually kind of really looks at the many different faces of Christmas. But I really do think that first one holds a very special place in terms of really giving the reader that Christmassy feel.
Definitely. The other one I particularly mention is The Christmas of the Yule Ball, which is book four.
Yes.
And it's a case of that's almost looking at the office party you didn't want to attend, or you know, the big social event where you know you're not going to be going with the person you want to be going with, just as they're sort of entering that painful puberty.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've seen. That's you know, teenager Christmas, where actually you feel like you're not allowed to have fun, or you haven't quite figured out how you want to have fun, and it's sort of a little bit awkward. But yeah, certainly Hogwarts is the place you want to be for Christmas. It's pretty spectacular.
Definitely. Okay, so do you want to take the next scene?
I do have Narnia next, but we're going to be talking about that, I think, together, so let's save that. So actually, I kind of want to mention Rise of the Guardians, which was a film from a few years back, and an animated film, which the entire film actually takes place around Easter. Basically, there's a really Christmassy feel the whole way through, probably because Father Christmas is actually part of it, but because the main character is Jack Frost. So he obviously brings all the snow and the snow days, and there's, you know, the whole aesthetic is ice, and all of that as well. So they really do kind of play on that Christmassy feel quite a lot. But something, when I first watched it, the thing that which kind of just made me go, ooh, was that obviously there are several scenes which take place in Santa's workshop. And the way they did the workshop, to be honest, anything which ever involves Santa's workshop, I think probably tickles, you know, the Christmassy vibe. Especially if it's done right, because it is that sense of wonder, isn't it? It's that sense of magic and excitement and joy and warmth that comes with it. And so also that feeling of creativity as well, which I think is actually fairly intrinsic to the Christmas vibe. And so they have these amazing shots of this humongous workshop with so many levels, and they've got all of the, you know, the workers there busy painting and creating. And that was all well and good until there's just this little bit where North, the Father Christmas, takes Jack into like his sort of his own little office, and it's just full of all of these ideas, and there are these different things kind of floating around, and all these ideas and prototypes of toys. And, you know, even though I don't get toys for Christmas anymore, I get excited seeing it all. And also the fact that you then have this big figure who's he's really ferocious in the film, but he's also very kind. And he takes this Russian doll and he says, you know, what do you see when you think of me? And he takes out each of the dolls inside of the other, saying, I have many, many layers, but inside my, you know, inside the core of me is a little child with eyes full of wonder. And I just went, ooh! I'm all Christmassy now.
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit, I've never seen the film. You've talked about it before, and it sounds like something I should track down at some point and actually watch, but my watching schedule is so thin, I haven't yet got around to it. But no, I can see why that would make film.
Mm-hmm. It's very nicely animated as well, which kind of really takes it. But when they do Santa's workshop well, you can't help but feel excited, you know, seeing toys being made, even as an adult. There's just something about seeing toys which kind of sparks that little, you know, excitement inside of you.
Yeah. Okay, well, my one is, I don't know, I've got a feeling my very Catholic upbringing might be betraying me, so that I'm sort of zeroing in on these particular things, but I'm not sure. I know I've mentioned Little Women as one of my to-watch Christmas films, even though only a small proportion of it takes place at Christmas. But the scene I'm particularly thinking of, or rather the pair of scenes that are connected, that I'm thinking of, is near the beginning of the film, whereby they are, the the four girls have gone down for breakfast, and they've actually, they're not very well off, but their housekeeper has actually cooked sausage and various other things for them. So they've actually got butter for a change, and oranges, and freshly baked bread. And it's like that, you know, you can see their faces are just lighting up with this amazing sort of meal, because breakfast is normally probably porridge or something. And then the housekeeper comes in and says, oh, you know, we should take a stick of firewood down to the Hummels because they haven't got anything. Your mother's been down there since early this morning. Their father's off somewhere. And there's five children. And you can see the four girls sort of all looking at each other without saying a word and coming to the idea that they'll do without their own breakfast. And the bit that gets me is sort of Amy, the youngest, still holding on to the orange till the last minute and like sighing and putting it back. and they are, it's sort of like, all of us know that this is the right thing to do. We're all of us calling the others to good behaviour here. But none of us really wants to give this up because we'd all rather eat the sausages and stuff by ourselves. And then the next scene sees them bearing this breakfast that's been covered up with plates and what have you, down the road to the Hummels on foot through the snow, obviously hungry themselves, but quite cheerfully singing "Here We Come A-Wassailing." And it's just, it's lovely, and not in a sense of, well, they're doing their Christian duty, just in the sense of they saw something that they could make a tiny bit better, and as one, as a group of four sisters, they decided that they were going to go and do it. And that it was an example of them all making the others better people in that one instant, if that makes sense. So it is very, it's a very family thing, but the anatomy of that scene is, I can't describe it. It's the way the four of them all look at each other as if to say, we all want to eat this, but we know this person is not going to get any dinner either, and we do have dinner coming later on.
Oh, yeah, that's really lovely. Oh, man. Sorry, it's not a film, but it just reminds me of this experiment I saw done where you see all these little children coming, you know, from low-income backgrounds, and they're asked, what would you want for Christmas? And these kids say, oh, I'd love an Xbox, I'd love a dollhouse, I'd love, you know, all these things. And then they said, what do you think your parents would want? Or your mother, or your father? And they'd say, oh, this, that, and the other, a new TV, etc. And then these presents are put before the kids and they say, right, you can take one home, either for you or for your parents. And all of the kids just, you see the look of longing on their face, and then without a doubt they all choose the gift for their parents instead. At which point basically the presenter says, well, you get to take both home. Of course you get to take both home. And it's just the fact that you then have the parents picking their kids up at the end, just crying and kissing them and stuff like that. Because it was just the fact that these kids were, clearly you could see the pain on their faces because they're like, we really do want this, but... And then just one of them said, well, you know, I'm going to get gifts on Christmas. My mummy always gets me gifts on Christmas, but she's not going to get anything. And I was just there like, oh, such good kids.
Yeah. I mean, a tiny cynical part of me is kind of like, okay, some of those children rumbled the fact that if they behaved well, then they would get everything. And some of them probably did. But yeah. I have to say there are an awful lot of, you know, smaller children, six and below, who are kind of like, no, I would do it that way because that's the right way to do it. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. A cynical part of me says they probably did figure that out as well. But there was also the risk that that wouldn't happen. And they took that risk, yeah, regardless. Definitely. And, you know, they were thinking of their parents. So that's really, really nice. Anyway, so, yeah, I can definitely see how that scene, Little Woman, would kind of bring out that Christmas spirit of giving, certainly. With that in mind, next up for me is probably The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Oh, okay. So which particular scene from that? Because I've got one, and I bet it's probably not the same one as yours.
Well, I think there are several sort of quite Christmassy scenes in that one, which kind of incite the feeling. But it's got to be, for me, at the end, when he kind of throws open his windows and shouts down to the boy in the street. And then he's running around just sort of putting it all, you know, putting everything together.
Yeah.
That makes me feel very Christmassy, and everyone's singing and, oh, it's good.
Yeah. We've obviously established this long ago that Madeline and I think The Muppets Christmas Carol is the most superior Christmas film ever made, and that everyone should watch it every year. I'm sure it was our recommendation one year as well.
I'm certain it was.
And it is a very, very Christmassy film. It's kind of in the title, obviously, but there are specific scenes in that, you know, work on you in different ways. And as Madeline says, that moment of enlightenment when he throws the window open, the spirits have done it all in one night, go and buy me the turkey kind of thing, just shows how much he has chosen to change. And it's that choice to change that's really important. And I think The Muppets Christmas Carol captures it really well. And a lot of other Christmas Carol adaptations skip over that. They don't seem to understand that it wasn't fear of death that got him. It was fear of not having had any significance, of the fact that he was leading an essentially pointless, selfish and empty life when he didn't need to be.
And the reason I actually like it is that another big Christmassy feel is obviously when you get the second spirit, the spirit of Christmas present, who is just so warm and cuddly. And that, you know, that's the moment of real change. And actually, you know, looking at it from an outside perspective, he's, you know, it's basically actually a story of overcoming trauma, which is that he had a very unhappy, you know, childhood. He made some mistakes, you know, when he got a little bit older, which were all based on kind of the situation that he grew up in and, you know, the circumstances of his childhood. And the first thing before he could do anything was to address that. And then having addressed that, he sort of learnt to live in the present a little bit more. So one of the significant changes actually happened with the second spirit. He's become immediately a lot kinder because he's been given a sense of perspective. And he's kind of been allowed to cast off those, you know, those iron shackles from his childhood, which have really been holding him back and have been blindfolding him. So it's not the fear of death, as you say. So the Christmassy feel thing, you know, really builds up, but it's, yeah, just at the end where he's just so overjoyed to know that he still has, that he has time, that it is still Christmas, and because he wants to celebrate Christmas. It's not that he's afraid of death, it's that he now wants to celebrate Christmas, and he's been kind of wanting to celebrate Christmas since the second spirit showed him all of the Christmas festivities, really.
Yeah, and he actually finally experienced that sense of connection with other people. I think that's the really important part, isn't it? The fact that, you know, we're not designed to go through life by ourselves.
Yeah.
Not really. Very few of us are, anyway. And that sense of coming together and connection was the important one. See, for me, the scene in that strikes me most as encapsulating Christmas, and it's going to sound really strange when I say it, but it's when he Scrooge as a young man and Belle releases him from the engagement, and this scene, the proper scene, isn't actually in the film on DVD or as it's shown on Sky or wherever anymore, because Disney Muppets sort of cut it out thinking that children wouldn't understand it, which was bullshit. But it was a song called When Love Is Gone, and it's all the reasons where she's very delicately and very kindly cutting him out of her life, because she's saying, you've learnt to value money more than you've learnt to value people. You've learnt to value greed and your own self-importance far more than you've learned to value me. And I don't think we're going to be happy together. You're putting off our wedding because you just want to make more money and you want the firm to do well, which is fine. I didn't mind the delay for a little while, but looking at it, the things we value now are kind of diametrically opposed. I'd rather be together and happy, but not particularly well off. And you would rather be well off than be with anybody else. Nothing matters to you as much. And it's so beautifully shot, because you get this sense that as a young man, Scrooge doesn't really understand what he's losing. He knows he's losing something important, but he doesn't understand what. And then you have Michael Caine as the much older Scrooge being forced to look back on this by the ghost of Christmas past and really understanding what he lost and where he really started to grow even colder and more solitary. No. So it's not like he moved on to someone else. All the way through the scene, Belle is given the high ground as well. So she's not being cruel. She's not saying, marry me or else. She's not demanding anything of him. You know, she's wishing him the best for the future. And I think it's great that the Muppets didn't then go on and do the next scene in the book, which is where Scrooge is having some weirdly Oedipal kind of feelings. I'm glad that they skipped that. Because it just, I don't know, it has so much impact. And it's a case of, this is what you, it's not a case of you must spend time with people at Christmas. But I think the idea of Christmas being this time when people come together and make that human connection, even if you don't do it for the rest of the year, is quite an important one. Maybe you don't do it at Christmas, maybe it's a Thanksgiving thing for you, or maybe it's an Easter thing, or what have you. But there must be times when you touch base with the rest of your species, I think. And he hasn't been doing it for years and years and years. And this is kind of, this is your turning point. This is where you went wrong. We're giving you another chance to turn in another direction. You're going to take it. And it kind of, Christmas can be about second chances as well. So that's why it really encapsulates it for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's an odd way of looking at it and not one that I would have considered. But your reasoning is sound.
But yeah, I can understand how people would say, hang on a minute, what do you mean that song where she's basically breaking his heart? That encapsulates Christmas for you. And it's a case of he's made a bad choice there. He's chosen to be alone. He's chosen money and wealth, which ultimately make life easier, but aren't worth very much when set against other things that you can't put a price tag on.
Yeah, and certainly the things which last. Because at the end of the day, money only keeps you warm in so much as it pays the bills, as it were.
I mean, we're not going to sneer at it because it definitely makes life easier.
It definitely does make life easier, and people who say money doesn't bring happiness clearly don't understand that means the senseless accumulation of wealth doesn't bring you happiness. Whereas, the security of money certainly, I think, can bring a lot of happiness.
It can pave the way to you actually being quite content, and that's the next best thing.
Yeah,
so, I feel like we're now doing an anti-Christmas carol. The anti-carol. Okay, my next one is, this is going to sound ridiculous because this is definitely a Christmas film. It was marketed as a Christmas film, and it's kind of an awful film. But there is one specific segment of it that I think beautifully encapsulates the feels of the season, as it were. And that is, it's Home Alone, but do you remember the old man who is the neighbour who just frightens the kid? He finds him really frightening because he's very stern looking. Now, for a start, that's really intelligent. That's a really intelligent way of looking at how children look at the world, whereby you're essentially powerless, even though he kind of isn't in that film, but you are powerless against the vast and uncomprehending world of the adults. And someone who looks at you like that is very frightening to a child. It's a case of you look at the emotional weather in an adult's face and decide how much you can get away with.
Yeah.
And I remember that feeling very distinctly. So he's frightened of this man all the way through. And then you get to the point where he's pushed into a position where he finds out that the old man's actually lonely and that he had a terrible argument with his own son and therefore he doesn't get to see his granddaughter. So the scene I'm thinking of is where this old man goes to see his granddaughter at the church singing in the Carol of the Bells, which is this beautiful, haunting Christmas carol for a start. And once again, it's looking at how... I mean, Kevin sort of persuades the old man to phone his son and, repair things, saying, if it was me, I'd want to hear from you, I'd want to know. And then you could go and see your granddaughter in person. If I was your granddaughter, I'd actually want to see it. I'd want to see my grandfather. And then he makes some sort of off-colour quip about, it's more presents. But he's actually right. This is a very wise... This is a piece of child's wisdom there, a piece of... nothing can be so bad from a child's perspective, that we cannot repair something in the family. Our natural state is to want things to be together. So despite the fact the film is kind of, it's very cheesy and kind of clunky in places now, there's this lovely sort of cameo section in the middle about how important family is, and the fact that even though we don't like each other a lot of the time, that doesn't get in the way of us sort of all caring about each other.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I completely agree with you, but also because I watched it last year and all I could think the whole way through was, and I'm pretty sure I said this in the episode last year, they are terrible parents. Kevin's family, they are terrible parents. Like, they should not be allowed to raise these children. They are really bad parents. And it was also the fact that, like, oh good, we're glad you're safe. Okay, now everything's back to normal. And it's like, no, you should be in absolute tears. You should be panicking beyond belief. You should just be, like, I seriously don't understand how they are all kind of so... They're really calm throughout, and then it's just like, oh, everything's okay, I guess. And I'm like, no! Everything is not okay! This is... You are very bad parents!
It's like the 8-year-old boy spent... Is it eight or nine spent, like, 3 days in a house by himself?
Yeah. Fighting off literal robbers. Anyway, so, so yeah, so on the one side, yeah, I completely get it that, you know, there is this great message about family, and maybe you don't always get on, but that doesn't mean that you're not very, you know, family, and family does matter. But at the same time, it's also, actually, if you have abusive family, you don't have to put up with them.
Yeah, totally.
That's one thing you shouldn't be putting up with. And I just do like the irony that Kevin's like, yeah, everything, you know, family's really important. I'm like, not in your case, Kevin. Your family are not good people.
Yeah. Okay, so your turn.
Okay, so this is not actually a Christmas one really at all, and yet I think it is 100% a Christmas film. And that is Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
So I can't actually name a scene of how this is a Christmassy film. All I can say is that the whole general feel of it incites in me that Christmas feeling. And it's probably because it has that sense of it being... It's an older film. It's a classic. And maybe it's because classics come onto the TV at Christmas, so you get those classic films. So you get the singing and dancing, you get that sense of the carnivalesque, almost, you know, that sense of everything being a little bit wacky, reality just being a little bit topsy-turvy, but in a very cheerful and joyful way. And they are incredibly cheerful, really, throughout it. There's great levels of humour. And there's just something about watching it that really, really brings out that sense of everybody just sitting down, you know, beside a crackling fire. You know, you've opened the presents, you're really full from lunch, and you've just got Singing in the Rain on. And that might be because that was the first time I ever watched it, was in those circumstances. But it just really entices that general sense of contentment. And also, I think, because a lot of classic films, there's a slowness about them, as well as this great kind of energy, because there's a lot of these dance moves and things like that. But there is also a slowness about them, which maybe you can't really appreciate in the heavy rush of the day-to-day that we go through in our lives. Whereas on Christmas Day, there's just this sense of great kind of,
yeah,
and breathe, you know, once the morning is done. And there's this very lazy sort of feel, which really suits with those kinds of classical films. So it feels very Christmassy for me. I don't know how you feel about it.
Honestly, it doesn't really fit me like that. But so I couldn't pick a scene out of it to say it feels Christmassy, because for me it wouldn't be. But that's fine, you know. Whatever works for you.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to mention... See, there's a bunch of films that sort of happen at Christmas, but they're not. You get Christmas as kind of a backdrop in them, and really, again, it's sort of a family drama and stuff in the middle. So I'm going to pick the one that I watch without fail yeah. every year, and it's going to surprise people because it's a romantic comedy. It's While You Were Go Sleeping. On. And Christmas is kind of a bit of a non-event in that, because the premise of While You Were Sleeping is that the main character kind of isn't really doing anything with her life. After her father's death, she's left alone in the world, and she works, and, you know, she has friends and things, but she's not seeing anyone, she's not going out, she's not really doing anything like that. You can't say she's depressed, but she's having difficulty making connections, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's this guy she sees who gets the train into the city every morning, and she thinks he's gorgeous. And she's never yet managed to, you know, she's been seeing him for about 3 or 4 months. She's never managed to say a word to him yet at all. He just buys his token at the booth at the railway station, and then he's off again. And then that one morning she ends up, because she has no family, her boss talks her into working Christmas Day, and it's horrible, manipulative and kind of shitty, but he's kind of like, oh, I promised my kids I'd be there this year, and she's like, oh, fine. And he comes rushing along, and he actually says Merry Christmas to her, just sort of really absently, not even really looking at her, and she's just like, ah, I had a chance to speak to him, I didn't get to. And she's feeling fed up with herself at this point. She looks up and he's being robbed, and the guys who are mugging him push him into the tracks. There's an express train coming the other way, and she sort of has a bit of a flap and then jumps on the tracks and rolls him out of the way of the train. So she manages to save his life, but he ends up in a coma. Then all his family turn up. He has a huge family, complete contrast, complete culture shock for her. You know, there's a brother, a sister, a grandmother, his father and his mother, and, you know, the family friend who's also the godfather. And the nurse tells them that she's his fiance, which they didn't know about. And it all goes south from there. Because when he finally does wake up, they're kind of like, this is Lucy, your fiance. And he's like, I have a fiance? I don't remember. So they say that he's got amnesia. And the trouble is, by that point, she can't. The only person who knows is the family friend, who's also the godfather. And he says, look, I heard you talking to him while he was in the coma. I know that you're not actually his fiance, but you know what? Don't tell the family yet, because at the moment they feel like they've got their son back. He's still in the coma, and this has been an awful Christmas for them. And by the time they get him back properly, when he's woken up, you know, they won't mind that you lied to them. And she's like, okay, if you think that's the best thing to do, you know them better than I do. But of course, they keep bringing her to family meals and things. And
yeah,
by the time he wakes up, she's kind of like, oh my God, I've got a family again, and I don't want to lose it. So she's carrying on with this thing of, you know, I guess I'm your fiancé. And they come very close to getting married, and she finally says, I can't do it, I've fallen in love with your brother.
Oh, wow.
It's a case of somebody doing something that isn't very, that is potentially morally reprehensible, but for the most understandable and human reasons, because she is a genuinely nice person. You know, and I say this, no sense of irony, she's really genuinely a nice person. And suddenly she's not alone anymore. And you can kind of understand how someone who has had difficulty, who has no family, has been sucked in at this time of year where everybody sort of gets pulled together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, all the way through, she and Lucy and Jack are kind of like getting on and then sparking off each other, because he's annoyed that she's going to marry his brother, and she's annoyed because she actually decided that she prefers Jack. But she can't tell him, and he can't tell her, because otherwise he'd be making... Anyway, it's ridiculous, and it's a ridiculous thing for me particularly to like, but it is a really, really festive film for me. Particular scene, they decide to have their Christmas Day or Boxing Day, because, you know, on Christmas Day they're actually in the hospital with their son who's in a coma. I mean, it looks like he's stable, but they insist that Lucy comes along, even though they don't know her. So she goes along to this Boxing Day thing, and she gets to, you can see her, you can see it through her perspective. She's there with this huge family who are all quarrelling and doing the Christmas bickering and giving presents and hugging each other, and there's presents for her. That suddenly a stocking has materialised with her name on it by the fireplace with bits and pieces in. And she doesn't really contribute a lot. She just sits there and sort of soaks it in, and you can see her sort of like filling up, as it were, like she's been this empty well for so long.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And it's just the whole idea of this family just embracing one more and saying, yes, you're one of ours.
Oh, that's really lovely. I'm going to have to watch this. It sounds hilarious.
I think you'll really like it. I mean, it's very early 90s, I think it is. But it's a must-watch every year for me. It just really captures the spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so next for me, mine's a fairly typical one, which I think a fair few people probably... certainly it appears a lot in memes for the Christmas kind of time, and that's Love Actually.
Yeah.
Which is actually... I think it's a film which has aged well, really, all things considered. And it really does represent all of those different sides to Christmas, which is... the sad sides of Christmas as well.
Yeah.
And one thing, you know, I like, looking back at it, is that one of the stories is obviously about a widower.
Yeah.
You know, who's lost his wife. And this is his first Christmas alone, and he's trying to take care of his son, who's actually kind of his stepson, really, as it were.
Yeah.
And they're very, very close. And that really, really, I really, really like that. That brings me, a very big Christmassy kind of feel, is that he's dealing with the grief of loss and the fact that this is the first holiday that he's had without her, you know. And yet at the same time, he's also kind of helping his son with his son's first love, really. And so for me, that kind of was very, very Christmassy. But also, for me, the thing that really kind of gets the real Christmas spirit in that movie is Colin Firth's character.
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
It's Jamie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Jamie.
He gets completely screwed over.
He does get really screwed over initially, and he falls in love with someone who he can't actually really even speak with.
No, I mean, she only speaks Portuguese, he only speaks English. And it's just, you're right, there's this lovely bit where they're finally sort of talking to each other, and he's answering her without knowing what she said, and they're so on the same wavelength, even though they don't know what they're saying.
Yeah.
It's like things like his book gets blown into the water, because he's using a typewriter, old-fashioned writer.
Yeah, exactly.
And she dives in to get it, he's like, oh god, and she's in. So he dives in after her. And she's like, oh my god, it's freezing. And he's like, oh, as long as there isn't eels. And she's like, watch out for the eels.
Yeah, she's like, and it's just, they're like, don't worry about it. It's just rubbish. This better be, you know, Dickensian good stuff.
It's like, this better not be some crap my grandmother could have written. And it's so funny.
But I do like the fact, it's just, they're like, don't splash too much, he'll attract the eels. it's great. But yeah, the really Christmassy bit for me is when he's marching down the street and all of her family is following him, and he's going to go and find her so that he can, you know, basically propose to her.
Yeah.
And his Portuguese is terrible, but he's just about kind of managing. And there he goes into the restaurant. And then she answers in English, and when he says, you learned English, and she says, just in cases.
Yeah.
And for me, that's so Christmassy, because it really incorporates that Christmassy sense of, you know, romance, but also chance as well. And that sense of fate as well. Like, any other time, this never would have worked. But because it's Christmas, you know? It has that feeling, really.
Yeah, it's sort of overcome barriers, perhaps. But,
yeah.
Yeah. because obviously the film deals with like the whole run up to Christmas and everything. And if you think about it, it's kind of insane to do it that way. But I still want it to work out for the characters. You can't help rooting for them.
Yeah. And recently, actually, I think it was this year, or maybe, yeah, I think it was this year, they actually released a kind of a very brief sequel, which you see, you know, where you see where all of the characters are at different points.
Yeah.
And it's actually really sweet.
I didn't see that. Oh, how did they manage the fact that Alan Rickman was dead?
I don't actually know. I don't know, but they might not have addressed that bit, but they did the others, but certainly that couple were still together. It was just really lovely. I'm still sort of struggling between the languages, which, to be honest, I really, really enjoyed it coming from a bilingual family.
Yeah.
It really, really made me laugh.
Okay, while we're on the subject of rom-coms, I'll just mention The Holiday briefly as well, which, mm-hmm. Again, is set at Christmas, but doesn't make Christmas Day itself this massive deal. And this is looking at two women who have, you know, one of them has been in a situation of being unrequitedly in love with somebody, and this person is well aware of it and quite likes fluffing them, you know, mm-hmm. dragging them along because it's convenient for them and this person is useful to them. And the other woman's been in a relationship with someone who's been cheating on her because she's a bit more emotionally closed off, but he hasn't helped her overcome that. He's just assumed that he should be the most important person in the relationship.
Mm.
So they're both thoroughly cheesed off, and they swap lives. They swap houses, cars and everything. So you've got this hotshot American trailer maker coming to a small Surrey cottage and having to deal with our country roads in England, which, by the way, are a big shock for Americans, I think. And you've got this English sort of journalist going over to Los Angeles and suddenly go, oh my god, it's a mansion kind of thing. And neither of them really go looking for love. One of them is she ends up hooking up with the English woman's brother, saying, you know, this is just going to be a casual thing. And he's like, yeah, okay, fine, because he's got reasons for it to be a casual thing as well. And it doesn't go that way for them. They aren't really looking for love, but it kind of goes that way.
Yeah.
And on the other side, you've got Iris, she ends up meeting this film director who is now in his 90s and forming a really strong friendship, and through him and obviously this other woman's contact, actually meeting someone as well. Again, non-intentionally, she's there trying to recover from this guy and just get over him.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to pick one moment that just seems Christmassy for either of them, because they're both alone in their own specific ways. But it's somehow the fact that they're alone and they decided to take a chance.
Yeah.
Eventually turns them into family. And it's a really nice, satisfying story.
Aww.
Have you not seen that one?
I have not seen that one.
You would like that one. that's Cameron Diaz and Kate Winslet.
Okay, alright. I'm gonna have to watch it.
All these films I'm telling you to put on your Christmas list.
Okay, so for my next one, I'm going to mention Hook.
Yay! I haven't watched that for years, but that was such a Christmas film.
Yes, it's just brilliant. It is a very Christmassy kind of film. Because it does actually take place at Christmas, and yet actually the majority of the film, it's not Christmassy, because it's actually kind of sunny.
Neverland. Yeah.
But it does actually take place at Christmas, and really kind of, you don't really get that many Christmassy scenes, but there's just this bit at the beginning where they're at the house. It's snowing outside, and Peter's wife, he's on the phone with, you know, doing business stuff, and Peter's wife just grabs his phone and tosses it out the window.
Yes.
And, you know, she's like, you are missing your children's lives. They will not last. They will not wait for you, kind of thing. So it really sets it up as the beginning of that Christmas, you know, that very typical Christmas film of, I'm not appreciating what I've got, really.
Yeah.
And then at the end, obviously, they're back in that wintry setting and everything is completely changed. I think he even finds the phone when he's trying to get back in, and he makes a whole joke about it, and then he climbs through the window and he says, what did I tell you about this window? And his son is like, because, you know, he's been shouting at his son for most of the film, you know, about closing the window and keeping it tight and stuff like that. Yeah. But then he just goes, always keep it open, and just grabs his son and twirls them around. And it's just it's just really, really nice family feels about a family who've all connected with each other, because the parent sort of kind of went back a bit and remembered what it was like to be a child, and that sense of wonderment and imagination and creativity, and joy, you know. Rufio.
Yeah, I mean, it's him finding his own sense of wonder as a child was really important for him actually completing the quest in the film and saving his children as well. So
yeah.
That was huge. I think it's also that Peter Pan as a pantomime used to be on a lot at Christmas, and probably still
definitely.
Is.
It is a Christmassy kind of story. In fact, I'm pretty sure that when it was released, it was around Christmas. It was a winter sort of film when it was first put on the stage. So yeah, and again, it's kind of got all those elements that you want in a Christmas story, that sense of the imagination, that sense of wonder, all of those things. And I think really a large essence, there's two main essences of Christmas. Well, three. One is family, the other is romance. And the third one is children. And that doesn't necessarily mean actual physical children, but that childlike sense of wonder as well. Which is, you know, the thing which makes us excited when we see toys, even as adults. It's the thing, you know, using childlike things, lots of magic, fairies. I said it, but I meant the nice kind, actually, this time. But, you know, magic and mysticism and all of those kinds of things. It's all about that child within us, I think. And Christmas is intrinsically linked with children in that way.
Yeah, totally. And it is a damn good film as well.
It's a very, very good film. And as I said, Rufio was iconic. To be honest, I don't think it's possible for me to mention Hook to anyone without almost instantly, every time I bring it up, people instantly go, Rufio!
I must be the exception then, because I was just like, he was just another character to me.
Oh no, it was just, oh god, as kids, we all wanted to be Rufio. He was so cool. Oh, the whole chant, it just goes round and round in my head. Anyway.
Okay, this last one, I think we probably better make it the last one, is one that both Madeline and I have on our list. I'm going from the perspective of the book, because the way it's described is quite interesting. No doubt Madeline will kind of weigh in on the film side of things as well. But this is The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which actually a lot of that book actually takes place in summer. The children are evacuated in the summer, and the rest of the book takes place in the summer, except for the bit at the beginning where Lucy goes through the wardrobe and she finds herself in a land of eternal winter. But never Christmas. Always winter, but never Christmas. And the scene that always gets me is the sound of sleigh bells when the beavers and three of the four children are trying to escape the White Witch. From outside, Mr. Beaver goes to investigate. There's a cry and they're all worried he's been caught. And then he's like, come and see, come and see. So they all pile outside into the snow. And it's Father Christmas. But it's the much more pagan Father Christmas. As in, he's not a jolly fat man. He's quite thin and severe looking. He obviously has the sleigh and the presents and everything else. But he speaks of portents, he speaks of prophecy and destiny and things like that as well. And then the presents he gives the children are brilliant. I mean, I would rather have a sword. But, I mean, it's weapons for Christmas presents because he gives them the things that they will most need in the fight ahead of them. Even though they are children, yeah. They are expected to fulfil this role. And it's a case of, I guess, yes, it is Christmassy, the fact that he turns up and provides a nice breakfast and everything, and it's Father Christmas, but it's not Father Christmas as you expect it. It's no. Father Christmas in the sense of, here are the tools that you will need in order to complete your quest. I mean, that's weirdly Christmassy. I can't explain why. It's not just the aesthetic either.
No, I'm going to go ahead and agree with you that, you know, I was actually going to come from it from the angle of the book as well, because I think in the film they do make Father Christmas a little bit more Christmassy in terms of what we would expect in how he looks and how they designed him. But yeah, the thing I really liked was the fact that initially they think they're being chased by the White Witch.
Yeah.
And so they're terrified. What's her name?
White Witch.
It is the White Witch. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was just getting confused in my head. So they think they're being chased by her, so they're actually really terrified, and they're kind of just being followed and followed and followed, and then they kind of look, and it's Father Christmas, which is brilliant. But also the thing that really gets the Christmassy vibe for me was that everything was very miserable, and winter is actually quite a miserable time. You know, we've addressed this in the past. Winter is quite a depressing time. And we compensate by that by having this very joyful kind of festival. Not in the middle of it, actually. We have it quite near the beginning of it.
Yeah.
Because winter really does linger, actually. But it is a very, very miserable time if you don't have that to look forward to. It's darker, it's colder, it's, you know, everything starts to die. It's really not actually that great. And so for me, I really liked it because they go from this very depressing period and instead you suddenly have this arrival of goodness and joy. But through the arrival of Christmas, of Christmas arriving, it's also a sign that actually the witch's power is weakening. Because yeah. She, up until that point, was able to stop Christmas from actually occurring. And so by Christmas actually arriving at last, it's this sense of hope that they're moving in the right direction, and that good things are coming, which I think Christmas is also about, just saying actually good things are coming, because as you say, it's also a chance of renewal and second chances and things like that. So there's a lot of symbolism in that too. And I also do like the gifts, the weapons and the healing and stuff like that. They all get weapons as well. I think even Lucy gets a little dagger. but yeah, it is really, really quite well done in that respect. I do like it. And it does feel very Christmassy.
So. Yeah. And I very much doubt that you ever saw the, was it very early 90s? Early 90s Chronicles of Narnia the BBC produced, which at the time was...
I saw some of it, which it was terrifying.
It was very cutting edge at the time, but I think going back and looking at it now, it was quite clunky. But it was very faithful to the books in a lot of ways, and they did a really good version of that scene with Father Christmas and everything. Of course, Edmund's not there, so Edmund doesn't get a gift bestowed on him, and that comes up later in Prince Caspian.
Yeah.
And I think Lucy, being a little delight, but also kind of a little bit dim on occasion, kindly turns and said, "Where's your present, Edmund?" And Edmund's like, "I wasn't there, remember? I just betrayed you to the White Witch." I didn't get rewarded.
It's just like, "I wasn't there, remember? I got roofied by the White Witch." Kind of betrayed you. And then was a prisoner for a vast majority of what was going on. Do you remember?
Do you remember how they were about to sacrifice me and then a load of eagles and centaurs turned up and rescued me? Oh, and then the lion died on my behalf. But hey, perhaps we just won't go into all of that.
Yeah.
No.
But yeah,
it's it's classic. It's so classic that you say Chronicles of Narnia, and I think people immediately think of the winter,
the Lion, the Witch,
and you know the winter land, sort of Narnia locked in 100 years of winter.
Yeah, well, it's that very typical. If you see a lamppost in snow,
yeah,
it's immediately the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Yeah, absolutely, it's immediately Narnia. They're intrinsically linked. So. Yes, so there we are. These are all of our Christmassy suggestions. So if you're looking to get in the Christmas spirit, guys, you might want to go and check out some of those films or those scenes and see if they if they put you in the right mood.
Yeah, definitely. So before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And Madeline has one for us this week.
I do. And this is a Christmas film, which is on Netflix. So you might have seen the ads for it. It's very good, guys. Beautifully animated, very touching, very, very well done. I thoroughly recommend it as a Christmas film. I really think that people will enjoy it. It's one of the good ones. It feels like a classic, and I do think that it will, in time, be one of those films that people return to. So yeah, thoroughly recommend it, and it is on Netflix, so definitely check it out. And on that note, all that's left to be said is that we wish you a very, very happy Christmas or happy holidays, whatever you're celebrating, whatever you're doing.
Season's greetings, cool you. A good solstice.
Basically, just have a great time, guys, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.